Hello, I'm Doug Price. This is number 0513, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0513. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet former punk rocker Bram Presser, who is the author of The Book of Dirt, which shares the story of his grandparents' Holocaust roots. Was it a difficult process to tell their story?
Doing that and learning where they'd been and particular episodes that had happened to them was very difficult. There was a point in writing the book, I mean, it took 8 years to write, and towards the end, I fell apart for about 8 months. I couldn't do it. But coming out the other side, I actually now feel it was a huge catharsis. I feel that I know them far better. I feel that I appreciate them much more.
NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on the program on NASA's new plans for commercial business.
This is the first time it's really been opened up for true space tourism. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is NASA's got to start saving some money on the station to concentrate on this Back to the Moon project they're doing with this new project called Artemis. And the station's expensive. It's billions of dollars a year, $3 to $4 billion a year just to keep it up there and operating. And also, they do want to stimulate commercial interest in space because the holy grail of this new space age, pretty broadly agreed, is finding ways to make money up there. And one way to do that is space tourism and then industry. So this is a way to sort of begin that move in both senses.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0513, was actor and broadcaster Doug Price. He is also the person behind Doug Price on Life, his audio vignettes, and you can find them on his website, which is Doug Price on Life. com. And by the way, you can go to the Stuff File page, go to the page for this program, which you just heard Doug mention, and you'll find that link to Doug's site. Ah, the circle of life. The circle of life. You know, Doug Price is a legend in the broadcast community. Thank you very much, Doug, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 49-year-old Lonnie Hutton was apprehended at the Boro Bar and Grill in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Now, according to police, an officer was dispatched to the bar where a witness said that Hutton walked to an ATM machine and pulled down his pants and underwear, exposing his genitals, and attempted to have sexual intercourse with the ATM. After his encounter with the ATM, Hutton began to walk around the bar nude, thrusting his hips in the air. Hutton was subsequently escorted from the bar and told to sit on a wooden picnic table. But once outside the bar, Hutton allegedly again exposed himself and again engaged in sexual intercourse, this time with the wooden picnic table. To the surprise of no one, police reported that Hutton smelled of booze, had bloodshot eyes, and slurred speech. Okay, when I first read this story, I tried to rack my brain to figure out which slot on an ATM could Lonnie even think of sexually assaulting. I don't have an answer, but I do know that's not the kind of deposit those machines take. And remember, some banks have penalties for early withdrawal. Now, you'd think that would be the only story of someone getting naked and trying to have sex with an inanimate object, but no, wait, there's more. In Naples, Florida, deputies responded to an incident of a male taking his clothes off, dancing strangely in a McDonald's. Witnesses believe the man must have been on drugs. The witness also stated that it looked as though the male was trying to have relations with a railing. Oh, I guess he likes them really thin. Deputies were dispatched to the McDonald's, where they recognized the man, 63-year-old John F. Morgan, whom they have had contact with in the past. Hopefully not the same kind of contact that Morgan was having with the railing. Anyway, Morgan was already brought in for trespassing at that location before. Morgan was placed under arrest and charged with trespass again. You know, maybe it's the railing. Maybe he spends his nights having pipe dreams. Yeah. A Florida man who had cocaine on his nose when the vehicle he was traveling in was stopped by police told arresting officers that the drug was not his. 20-year-old Fabrizio Jimenez was a passenger in a car that was pulled over during a morning stop in Tampa. When a Hillsborough County Sheriff's Office deputy approached the auto, the female cop immediately noticed Jimenez had a white powdery substance on his nose that she recognized to be powder cocaine. Jimenez's nose was subsequently swabbed by police, and a field test returned a positive result for the presence of cocaine in the sample. A search of Jimenez yielded a small bag of cocaine, while police also seized a backpack containing 250 grams of marijuana and 13 Xanax pills. Jimenez, arrested on 3 felony narcotics possession charges, attempted to tell the deputies the cocaine on his nose was not his. It does not appear Jimenez offered an explanation as to how someone else's cocaine got on his nose. Well, if he got it from a drug mule, that's a visual I really do not need. Yeah. Anyway, the caller said the car's battery had died, but instead of heading that way, the tow truck driver relayed the vehicle's location to the Oregon State Police. They were looking for that car. The driver is accused of threatening his stepfather with a gun, and troopers and county deputy sheriffs found 34-year-old Jeremy Hotha Thomas, who was still waiting for the tow truck. His car battery, however, wasn't the problem. According to authorities, he had put diesel into his gasoline-powered car. Thomas was charged with menacing, unlawful use of a weapon, burglary — he allegedly also stole the fuel — theft, and being a felon in possession of a firearm, and is being held without bail. Was his gun loaded with the right kind of ammunition? You know, this is not a bright boy. It's a good thing that he's not getting bail, because I'm guessing that his stepdad wouldn't be picking him up anyway. That's not the only getaway that didn't work. Here's another. When a 2016 Dodge Challenger came into the Mannheim Auto Auction Facility in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, by truck, an employee started inspecting the car and taking photos to prepare it for auction. That employee, Darren Lead, said, "I opened the trunk to take a trunk picture, and there was a guy in there." Leeds ran to get the man some water, as he wasn't moving a whole lot. After hospital treatment, police identified the man as 25-year-old Leon Shaheem Parks of New York, and he had a warrant out for his arrest for weapons and parole violations. Immediately, speculation started about how Parks ended up locked in the car's trunk. "We asked the security people," said one auction house employee. "We thought they were kidding. But Arnold Kubanoff is clued in. Unfortunately, a lot of drivers leave their cars open," he said. "I started locking my cars after I saw a bomb." Seriously? A bomb? Wow. Well, thank goodness for remote keyless entry. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we're not done yet with cars. A shoplifter at a Walmart in Clayton, North Carolina, was confronted by store security, who says she had put merchandise in her purse and left the store. The woman became aggressive and ran, but police quickly found her hiding in the trunk of her own car in the parking lot. It was a 90-degree day, and they found that she was glistening green. 34-year-old Melinda Reeves told officers she had dumped Mountain Dew on herself to try to cool down in the sweltering vehicle. Officers found the loot, a bottle of wine, some laundry detergent, and a Little Mermaid children's toy, total value $16.83. She was arrested and booked on $2,500 bail. I'm just wondering, how long was this numbskull willing to hide out in a parking lot in the trunk of her own car on a hot day? Not a bright woman. By the way, if she wanted to cool herself off, wouldn't it have been easier to drink the Mountain Dew rather than pour it all over herself? Then again, I'm not a fan of Mountain Dew, so maybe it is harder to drink it. I don't know. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Bram Presser is the former frontman for the internationally acclaimed punk rock band Yidcore. He's also the author of The Book of Dirt. It traces the Holocaust roots of his grandparents in a book that is part memoir, part investigation, part novel. Bram joins us on the line via Skype from Israel. Hi, Bram.
How are you?
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Now, I understand Australia is your home, right?
It is. Yeah. I'm visiting family here. My partner's sister lives here. So we thought while we're zipping around the world, we'll drop in, as you do.
And you have been zipping around the world. You were in New York a little while ago, and you're on a tour promoting this book.
Yeah, I'm just wherever it's at, wherever it's willing to listen to me talk, I'll be there.
Now, I know that this is not the first tour you're doing for this book. You had one late last year. But as I mentioned, you're the former frontman of Yidcore. So how different is it to tour with a band as opposed to touring with a book?
The main difference is sleeping on concrete floors versus sleeping in hotels, I think. otherwise, it's actually kind of scarily similar. I strangely find talking about the book a lot more nerve-wracking, I suppose, than standing on stage, screaming into a rubber chicken. I think there's something kind of impersonal about the punk thing, where you're kind of on a stage and you're removed from quite large audiences, and you're it's almost a persona. And you're just being as wild and silly as you can. And it's not like, the book is so intensely personal that when you're talking about it, you feel like you're literally kind of just, opening the door to your soul and putting it out there for people to either, engage with or actually not criticize or what have you. So it's there's definitely like a performative similarity, but the book stuff is a lot harder.
Now, as I said in the introduction, your book is part memoir, part investigation, part novel. That's an interesting hybrid for a book, especially one that deals with such a serious issue as the Holocaust. How did you go about deciding to do the book in this type of format?
It was actually totally organic. What happened was my grandparents died in 1996. They had never told their Holocaust stories, and we had kind of an idea of what their stories were. And then a couple of years after, they died about 6 weeks apart from one another. And about 2 years after after they died, this article was published in the local Jewish press in Melbourne, in Australia, claiming to tell my grandfather's story, and it was completely different to what we knew. And it said that my grandfather had been selected by the Nazis to be the literary curator of Hitler's Museum of the Extinct Race in Prague. So I then, I wanted to look into which of the versions of his story was true. And so I started this kind of just a bit of, I don't know, it was almost like cursory digging at the beginning. And then it just got kind of bigger and bigger. And the thing that became apparent quite early is that there were no records. No one was speaking. And so I didn't really have much to go on. So I thought, you know what, I'm going to start from the start, because I knew that he had been like a rabbi's son in a country town out in the the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains in what's now the Ukraine. And I thought I'd write a little chapter about his childhood. And then I kind of liked this kind of getting to know them through fiction. Like I felt that I suddenly had this grasp of him, and, you know, in a way I hadn't before. So I continued with that. And then as I was writing, evidence started appearing, like different people found different things, like the Jewish Museum of Prague happened upon like a whole pile. They were digitizing their records, and they just found a whole lot of records with my grandfather's name in them, like timesheets and ration cards and things like that. And so and it was for a project. It was for like a secret project, and they didn't actually know what the project was because it had a code name rather than an actual description of the project. So they gave that to me, and then a guy who had heard that I was searching contacted me. He was in his 90s from he lives now in England, and he had been trying to track down the people in his class photo, and the only person he couldn't find was his teacher, and his teacher had a name similar to my grandfather's name. So he got in contact with me, sent me the class photo, and clearly it was my grandfather. And so, yeah, all these sort of things started appearing. My cousin in Prague found a bushel of letters in his mother's, after she died, at the back of his mother's closet. And these were letters that were sent by my grandmother from concentration camps to her mother in Prague. Her mother was a convert, so she wasn't taken to concentration camps. So we had these letters basically detailing the experiences of my grandmother in the concentration camps, written from the concentration camps. So anyway, I had all of these things. And so because I had both, and I really, like, I thought both, you know, the fictional retelling and the records I was finding were important parts of the story, and also the story of actually trying to, my own personal search, I thought that it was probably, that I needed to find a way to bring them all together. And I kind of stumbled quite by chance upon a book called Trieste by Dusan Drindic, who's a Croatian writer. And that kind of introduced me to the world of documentary fiction. And I was like, this makes sense to me. This is how I can tell the story. And so she actually strangely became a mentor to me. And she actually kind of guided me a lot in the writing of it, and just trying to help me understand how fiction and fact and document can work together in telling a whole story. So yeah, it was organic. It was totally not something I'd planned. And I think it's the only way the book could work. And so, you know, thankfully I stumbled on that book, really.
Now, the grandparents you refer to, are they your father's parents or your mother's parents?
Mum's.
And is your mother still alive?
Yeah, she is. She is. She knew nothing. She was actually, it was very interesting. I said to her at the very beginning, or rather, she said to me at the very beginning, she said, look, you're welcome to go on this kind of goose chase if you want, but are you willing to find things that you're not going to be, like, happy with? Because you may come across things that do not paint your grandparents in good light. And I said, yeah, look, I am. And she said, okay, then go for it. But just no, because she knew that, like, my grandfather's like my hero. Like, they died when I was 19. So I was very close with him through my childhood. My grandfather particularly, he was like, we were inseparable, right? So Mum was very eager, I suppose, to ensure that I wasn't going to do something that would hurt my memory of him. Thankfully, what I found out was even more extraordinary than what I thought. But, you know, I was willing to find out bad things.
Was the process of doing this book, during the time you were going through that process, was it in any way cathartic for you or your mom or the two of you together?
Look, Mom actually, interestingly, didn't really want me to tell her. She wanted little bits and pieces, but she didn't want too much of the story before I wrote the book. She was like, I want to get it as a whole. Like, you know, if you find out amazing things, tell me those things, you know, in like just particular highlights, but the totality of it I want as a book. For me, it was actually, I have to say, incredibly difficult, often quite heartbreaking. What I realized was I was essentially reanimating my grandparents just to, in detail, put them back through, you know, the most horrific experience of their lives. So in that way, it was actually very difficult because you know, when you grow up and you know your grandparents are survivors, there's, you don't think of it in the reality of it. You know, it's a conceptual thing that, yes, they went through the Holocaust and it would have been, you know, horrific, but you don't think about the day-to-day aspects of it. And doing that and learning, you know, where they'd been and particular episodes that had happened to them was very difficult. But at the same time, and I have to say, I actually there was a point in writing the book. I mean, it took 8 years to write, and towards the end, I fell apart for about 8 months. I couldn't do it. But coming out the other side, I actually now feel it was a huge catharsis. I feel that I know them far better. I feel that I appreciate them much more. I only regret that I couldn't have known this when they were alive, particularly because I found out things about them that made me understand some of the guilt that they had, and made me know, actually, that the guilt that they had was, I mean, of course, guilt in these situations is always going to be irrational, but like the things that my grandfather blamed himself for, like, I looked into those episodes, they just weren't his fault. I wish I could have shown him the evidence, you know, so that he, to his dying day, he blamed himself for his mother's death and his best friend's death. There was absolutely no way he could have saved them. He believed he could, right? And so I wish I could have sat down after having done all this and spoken to them. But, you know, given that I couldn't, I can't. It was still incredibly cathartic to really know them as people and appreciate, you know, their struggle, their suffering, and actually the incredible nature of their, you know, coming out the other side and living full, quite amazing and really beautiful lives.
We're talking with Bram Presser, author of the book of Dirt. We'll take a quick break and continue our conversation on the other side. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And this is indeed the Stuff File Program, heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're talking with Bram Presser, the former frontman for the punk rock band Yidcore and the author of The Book of Dirt, which traces the Holocaust roots of his grandparents. Bram, your title, The Book of Dirt. Why is it called that?
A number of reasons. Firstly, because I had this great idea in my head. I actually had the title of the book before I even started writing. So knowing that my grandfather was involved in this book sorting project, I was trying to think about why would he never speak about it, that particular aspect of it. And not only that, the actual project he was involved in, it wasn't quite what the article said, but it was this group called the Talmud Commando who were tasked in Theresienstadt with sorting Jewish books that had been stolen from collections all around the occupied Reich lands. And of the about seven or so survivors of this group, none of them ever spoke about it. None of them spoke to each other again after the war. And so I had this idea, maybe they found something that was like particularly difficult or incredible, or something that was then lost that they blame themselves for. Anyway, I had this idea that they came across this old siddur, like a prayer book that was hollowed out, and inside was a clump of dirt, and that dirt might have been the heart of the golem, which is the great Jewish mythical man of dirt made by a Czech rabbi in the 1600s. It's kind of the it's like a man of clay and it's built from the dirt of the riverbanks of the Flatava River, and life is breathed into it through holy words and incantations. And, you know, it was this. There were various different versions of the story, but you know, it was kind of the savior of the Jewish people against kind of, you know, pogroms and anti-Semitic events and what have you. So I had this idea that they had found this, and like beyond that as well, I thought the golem was actually a great metaphor across the board in the book, because I wanted to have a just the idea that I was collecting, in the colloquial sense, dirt, you know, gossip, bits of information, what have you, about my grandparents, and from that I was building them back into humanoid characters, and so I had this idea that I was making golems of my grandparents. So, you know, that was the dirt as well, and then also then there's just the general kind of dirt and squalor of life as it was in the camps. I should point out the camps are actually only the last section of the book. Most of the book is actually about their time in pre-occupied Prague and occupied Prague, and then it goes into the Holocaust aspect.
You mentioned that it took you 8 years to write this book, and that it was rather cathartic for you to do. In learning more about your grandfather, and the fact that you were so close to him up until the time of his death when you were 19, did you actually learn anything about yourself?
I learned that I can't let go. The sensible thing at any point, at numerous points actually in this book, was to have walked away. I learned about kind of myself in the context of my family. I understood my place in the family, and particularly what I represented to my grandparents a lot more. I learned a lot about myself as a writer, and about what I love and how I love to like kind of my love of fables and that was a big part of it. But like, I don't know, like it was one of those, I really felt weirdly that it wasn't about me, other than my kind of tenacity in trying to get the story. So yeah, I think that, that was the most I learned about myself, but really I and given that I'm someone who, you know, likes to be looked at on a stage and jumping around and performing, it was probably a little strange for me to realize that I can sometimes say it's not all about me.
In writing a book about the Holocaust and writing such a personal story about the Holocaust, did it have any effect in reconfirming or strengthening your own faith?
Well, it's interesting because I don't consider myself you know, a religious person, or, you know, a person particularly of faith. What it did actually confirm is, like, although you see like the worst of humanity, it actually confirmed my faith in humanity, in the goodness of people, because a lot of my grandparents' survival was contingent on the you know, help and goodwill of others, some of whom themselves are also going through horrific experiences, and so you know, I really felt that. And especially at the moment where times are not looking particularly wonderful, that I think I have a slight, I suppose, a stockpile of faith that the goodness of people in general will win out in the end, even if, you know, horrors ensue in the meantime. So I think that was kind of my main takeaway in that sense. But I think gained an appreciation for the faith of others, if that makes sense. That, like, to a respect for the place of faith and the need for faith that some people have. And I think it's easy to be dismissive, but it's actually an incredibly, it can be an incredible source of goodness and altruism and what have you. And so that, I think that was actually quite lovely as well. And that's something that kind of, to me also, like it crossed faiths, because, you know, it's not particular to any, you know, faith group. It's what, like, I particularly liked that I saw different faith groups helping each other out. And I think that's like something that's particular, of particular, like, importance these days.
Well, you talk about the times that we live in nowadays, and the sad reality is, with some of the, you know, darker sides of the internet and social media, and the fact that just by attrition, members or survivors of the Holocaust are dying off, and in some cases their story is dying with them.
Yes.
The growth of late of Holocaust deniers.
Yes.
How do you feel about that, especially writing such a personal book like this?
Look, I think the importance is to keep documenting, to keep telling stories, to keep writing about it, and also to, you know, to contextualize and to tell the human stories, because it's just, you know, it needs to continue to be part of the conversation, because as we move, like, we are not far away from a world where there will be no survivors, and you know, the question is then who carries the torch. And I think this is true of all, you know, genocide, and that I think, you know, every genocide has its deniers, and I think it's very important to, I mean, you look at the Armenian genocide, and it's important to keep telling the stories, to keep, you know, because these are universal lessons. These are things that you know, everyone you know, needs to learn about the dangers of where intolerance might lead, or, you know, or the dangers of thinking of people as other, or you know, not understanding the common humanity. And the Holocaust is kind of the archetypal example. And it's interesting, Trieste, the book I was talking about, the Dasha Drindich book, I asked her actually at one point, I said, why did you, because she wasn't Jewish, I said, why did you write about the Holocaust? You know, you come from Croatia, you had your own genocide more recently. And she said, yeah, but, you know, the Holocaust is the kind of the universal avatar for inhumanity. And I just think that, you know, Holocaust denial is you know, an unfortunate reality, but it's one that needs to be continuously confronted, disproven purely by fact and by continuing to tell and continuing to remember. And this is important, like, you know, these people, you know, 6 million Jews, you know, a lot more, you know, people who weren't Jewish as well, perished, and it's important to honor their memories, like every single one of them, by continuing to talk about it and tell their stories.
The book is called The Book of Dirt. And Bram, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much. It was great to be on.
Bram Presser, author of The Book of Dirt. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this program, which is show number 0513, and you'll find links to Bram's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Stick around. There's more Stuff File coming your way in a moment.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to NASA expert Rod Pyle about NASA's commercial business. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and a lot more Stuff File news to share with you here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcast and Apple Podcast. Just click on the Google Podcast or Apple Podcast button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. Investigators in Broome County, New York, say that 25-year-old John S. Main of Florida had quite a spree. First, they say, Main crashed a car stolen in Florida on the interstate near the Pennsylvania border and tried to flee the scene by jumping on the back of a van that had slowed to go by the wreck. He fell off, so he jumped into the back of a pickup truck. When that surprised driver pulled to the side of the road, Main ran into the woods. Police combed the area but didn't find a sign of him until a homeowner called 911 to say he found a man in his chicken coop. And after confronting him, the man chased the homeowner with a hatchet and then stole an ATV to escape. Police intensified their search, but that was interrupted by another homeowner calling 911, who said he found a man in his chicken coop who was not wearing any clothes. It was Maine, who was subdued by a police dog and taken into custody on multiple charges. Well, you gotta applaud his determination. And by the way, how would you like to be subdued by a police dog while you're naked? Yeah, I'm sure surrender was pretty darn quick. Well, Marcy Flores of Pasadena, Texas, had everything ready to go for her daughter's high school graduation party and headed to Walmart to pick up the cake that she ordered. They didn't have our order, Flores found when she got there. They didn't have anything ready. Employees were apologetic and offered to decorate any of their other cakes in stock and give it to her for free. She chose one. They did the decorations, and she took it home. But the alternative wasn't quite what Flores expected. The replacement cake was a frosted block of styrofoam. Not only did they mess up one time, she complained, they did it twice. She again complained to Walmart, which gave her a gift certificate, but when a reporter followed up, a store spokesman shrugged it off with a terse statement, "Incident was a result of a misunderstanding. The matter has been resolved." Oh? Just a misunderstanding, you say? So, what you're saying is someone in your store thought that a customer would want an icing-decorated styrofoam cake. That's the story you're sticking to? And you're qualified to be the store's spokesman? Well, that kind of explains the qualified staff who did the cake. A Florida man is facing a domestic battery charge after allegedly covering his sleeping girlfriend in ketchup. Investigators say 37-year-old Peter Wagman and his 41-year-old girlfriend have recently been in arguments over infidelity by the victim. The couple, who live in Pinellas Park, have been together for 11 years. At around 4:45 a.m. Sunday, police report, the victim awoke to ketchup being poured on her by Wagman, who was yelling, "That's what you get, bitch!" When police arrived at the residence, they found the woman covered in ketchup. Wagman denied the condiment attack, although a police patrolman noted that he has ketchup on the right side of his pants. Both Wagman and his girlfriend have previously been arrested for battering each other. Wagman, who was released from the county jail, had pleaded not guilty to the misdemeanor domestic battery count. You know, I'm not sure if they're talking about battered in the sense of a crime or if his next step after pouring ketchup on her was to try and roll her in flour. I think her biggest fear when she woke up is if she saw him coming at her with a fork. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, around 1:40 a.m. on May 9th, as an unnamed Cocoa, Florida homeowner slept in her garage, a black Cadillac crashed into the structure, missing her by only inches. The Cadillac was stolen, it turns out, and was fleeing an Orange County Sheriff's Office patrol vehicle, which was also stolen and being driven by someone impersonating a police officer. After the crash, the imposter patrolman continued trying to pull over vehicles before speeding away. The patrol SUV was later abandoned behind a shopping plaza in Cocoa. Okay, I don't know about you, but I'm left with more questions after reading this story than I had before. For instance, what are the odds that a stolen vehicle is being chased by a stolen police car? And also, why is the homeowner sleeping in her garage? One could stock up all of these answers with the catch-all that this is Florida, but even that seems too easy in this case. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The folks at NASA are, for the first time, opening the International Space Station to commercial business and more private astronauts. So I thought it would be interesting to talk to a NASA expert about this latest development. Rod Pyle is back on the show with us to talk about it. He's the editor-in-chief for Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society, and he's also the author of more than a dozen books, including First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. Rod joins us once again from California by Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hey, how are you?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. So, this is something that's new for NASA, but it's not necessarily new to the space station. If I understand it correctly, the Russians have been doing something like this in the past with some of their own private industries.
Yeah, so they started with their Mir space station back in the 90s, and there was a company formed mostly by U.S. citizens called Mir Corp. And between them and the Russians, they managed to fly a number of people up to the Mir station and then later expanded that to the ISS. And it's always been a little uncomfortable because NASA's not in favor of private astronauts, at least they weren't until now, for some reasons that are good. It's not that much money. I mean, it's expensive to get up there, but that's mostly involved in the cost of the flight. The actual time on the station isn't particularly profitable. Although if you're in the Russian program, it is, because they're running much leaner than the U.S. is one. They're about a tenth our budget. And also there are some concerns, you know, that astronauts go through the spaceflight participants, they call them, go through very limited training. So in certain situations, they'd be constrained as to what they could or would know how to do. They haven't had those hundreds of hours of simulation that NASA astronauts and cosmonauts go through in Russia. And also, there's a lot going on in the space station. There's a lot of research. There are engineering concerns, and at this point, because it's been up there almost 20 years, about half the time the astronauts spend up there is on maintenance and servicing, and frankly, you know, a tourist could get in the way. So they're given some basic tasks to do often, but really they're just there to enjoy the ride, and that could be kind of invasive if it's not handled properly. So that was always, I think, the big concern.
Well, now the International Space Station is just that, international. Several countries are involved. In the past, did NASA, even though they didn't necessarily agree to allowing Soviets to bring up other people besides astronauts, is it something they had to sign off on? And conversely, now that NASA is wanting to do this, do other countries have to sign off on it?
Yeah, as you point out, it's an international project, and it was by design from the very beginning. The big reason was the U.S. government wanted to bring the new Russian Republic into the game because the Soviet Union had failed, and it was time to try and consolidate some efforts. So there's always been a question as to how much money we actually saved, because not only did we put over $75 billion into the station in those dollars back in the 90s, but also we were flying the components up on the shuttle, which is a huge additional cost. So who really owns it? Well, all the entities own it. So U.S., Russia, Japan, Europe primarily. But, you know, who controls that? Do they control just their percentage, or do they have a larger voice? This has been an ongoing discussion, and NASA had to just kind of nod and say, okay, if the Russians want to do it, they own a big chunk of the space and of the station, and they provided the first module that went up there and so forth. So we kind of have to let them do what they want. Now, that said, NASA, although they hadn't flown tourists, they had flown payload specialists from private corporations before, and individual astronauts from other countries, such as Mexico and Saudi Arabia, who were the first nationals from those countries to go up into space. So there's been kind of a move in that direction, but this is the first time it's really been opened up for true space tourism. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is NASA's got to start saving some money on the station to concentrate on this Back to the Moon project they're doing with this new project called Artemis. And the station's expensive. It's billions of dollars a year, $3 to $4 billion a year just to keep it up there and operating. And also, they do want to stimulate commercial interest in space, because the holy grail of this new space age, pretty broadly agreed, is finding ways to make money up there. And one way to do that is space tourism and then industry. So this is a way to sort of begin that move in both senses.
You've already mentioned some figures, what it cost NASA to operate the station from their perspective for a year, $3 to $4 billion. Some of the costs involved, I understand, to possible tourists or companies that will use it. The space station facilities, it'll cost $11,250 per astronaut per day to use the life support systems and the toilet, and $22,500 per day for all necessary crew supplies like food, air, medical supplies, and more. Even power will cost $42 per kilowatt hour, and ultimately one night's stay would be about $35,000 per person, and that's just while they're up there. There's a lot of costs involved to getting people trained to go up, and an initial fee to be involved in this. So it's a big ticket item for those who want to do it, and I'm assuming it's more for a business situation. I hear stories like perhaps movie companies will want to shoot from outer space, and this is one of the ways they'd be able to do it, that kind of thing.
Right. So just the ticket to get there is estimated to be about $52 million. And then all those additional costs are citing once you're there. They're going to limit the stays up to 30 days only, and they're only going to fly 2 a year, at least to start, starting in 2020. So there's a significant cost of getting up there. You've got to be a well-heeled individual. That said, there's plenty of well-heeled individuals. One of the questions that occurred to me when I was looking through this material was, what do we do if a Chinese tourist wants to go up? Right now, it's limited to American citizens on the NASA side. But if the Russians are going to do it, and they have their Soyuz launch vehicle, if a Chinese citizen wants to go up, how does that work? Because we have all these trade sanctions against the Chinese, including ITAR restrictions, which are trying to limit the transfer of sensitive technologies. So how that will be handled is going to be interesting. But, you know, in the big picture, we ultimately need, and the space station was the first big step in this direction, we need international cooperation in space to make this work. It's going to take the best and brightest from all these countries and India and all the other emerging space powers, which are slowly coming to the fore, including Japan and others, to work together to make something like a Mars mission happen effectively. So hopefully we can get some of these things ironed out, and it would be really neat if it happened on the commercial side first.
Speaking of commercial, one of the things that's also difficult, which I understand is would involve private corporations in general, would be it's one thing for NASA to say they're opening the space station to commercial business. It's another thing to get them there, because there is nothing currently flying out of the U.S. to the space station. And this is all contingent on people like SpaceX and with their Crew Dragon spacecraft and other companies to get them up there.
Right. And we haven't proved those spacecraft to be human rated yet. That's the ultimate goal. But they've been working on it a long time. They're behind schedule. Part of that's because Congress wasn't appropriating enough money early on for this program to get the commercial entities involved. But it's primarily at this point SpaceX and Boeing. They've both been working on space capsules for a long time. SpaceX, of course, has its own rockets, and Boeing is part owner of United Launch Alliance, which has rockets. So they're pretty close, but as we saw about, 2 months ago, SpaceX had that, quote, anomaly, unquote, where their Dragon 2 capsule exploded when they were testing the abort system. So there are very real dangers involved, and it's going to take a while to iron these things out. But those are the rides. One other thing that hasn't been fully addressed yet, although I think they've got it worked out for this particular endeavor, but in the big picture, someone has to decide how much risk we allow private citizens to take. You know, if you're an astronaut, you know what you're signing up for, and it's dangerous, and that's part of the deal with NASA. But if you're a private citizen, this isn't just like getting on a 737 and flying somewhere and knowing that there might be problems with it. This is going to space, which is inherently dangerous. You're sitting on top of a large controlled bomb, basically, that's controlling the burn of the chemicals in it, you hope. How much risk do we let people take, and what kind of limitations are there, and what kind of waivers do you sign, and how quickly do lawyers of the bereaved, if there is an accident, punch through those waivers and start suing people? So there's a lot of things to be worked out in the long haul, but they've got this stuff settled for now, I think.
Well, speaking of the risk involved, you've done work for NASA in the past. You've written several books. You are a NASA expert. Given the opportunity, if someone were to pay the freight, would you go?
So I've never seen a Soyuz capsule interior in person. I've seen the outside, and I know how small they are. When you get inside, there's all kinds of storage and stuff in there, so you're really packed in shoulder to shoulder with two other people for each flight. I've only been inside a space capsule once. It was a Gemini capsule, and they sort of closed the hatch to give you an idea of how small it was, and I started to sweat immediately. So I'm one of those people that gets a little nervous and the elevator takes too long to open once it's arrived on a floor. So probably not. I love the idea. I'm just not sure I'm cut out for it, because those people are a special breed and they're not claustrophobic. So that could be a problem. Would you go?
No, but
okay.
It never crossed my mind at any time, in any form, in any way whatsoever. By the way, apparently NASA hopes to start doing this by as early as 2020, and if I check my calendar, that's just next year.
Yeah, and they have a lot of things to overcome before we get there. They've got to finish flight testing and then do human tests with both these systems, the SpaceX and the Boeing capsule. They've got to finish up whatever legislative work they have to worry about, and there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, we've got this. We've got the continued operation of the space station. We've got this return to the moon initiative, which is a huge endeavor. We don't have a lander yet, although Jeff Bezos is working on one of his own. We don't even have spacesuits that could be used for walking on the moon's surface for more than a short time. So there's a lot of things to concentrate and worry on, and there's a lot of intersections between now and the gap, let's say, between 2020 and 2022. And they've got a lot of marks to meet, so it's going to be an interesting challenge.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I will, at the very least, go to the Cape and wave. That's about it. Rod, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thanks. My pleasure. Anytime.
NASA expert Rod Pyle, author of First on the Moon, the Apollo 11 50th Anniversary Experience. He also has other new titles you might want to check out, including Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0513, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. We still have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, but we do have several more Stuff File news stories to share with you right here, right now, like this one. For reasons that remain unclear, a local police officer drove a beach patrol ATV into a marsh on Tybee Island, Georgia, on May 31st, where it became stuck in the mud. Officials with the Georgia Department of Natural Resources say the officer then used a City of Tybee pickup truck to try to free the ATV, but the truck also became stuck. City workers next attempted to pull both vehicles out using two backhoes, which also succumbed to the marsh. An excavator was finally able to free one of the backhoes from the muck, but the Coastal Resources Division of the DNR says it will likely take a barge and a crane to excavate the other three vehicles. Tybee City officials are conducting an investigation. Gee, it makes you kind of wonder, when they do get the barge and crane, as to just what else they might find in that marsh. Officers in Alamogordo, New Mexico, spotted a suspicious car that they say sped off, leading to a chase that ended when the driver lost control and smashed into a street sign. According to officers, all four of the occupants smelled of alcohol and the driver was arrested. The driver's name has not been released because she's 12 years old. Officers called the girl's father and told him they were trying to figure out where she and her friends, all aged 12 to 13, got the booze. "That's what I want to know, because we don't drink in my house," the father said. "If you've got to keep her in jail tonight, if you think it's right, do it." The driver allegedly admitted to waiting for her grandfather to fall asleep and then taking his car to pick up her friends and go drinking. She was charged with DWI and leading police on a chase, and all four were charged with underage drinking. Oh, they're probably all going to be grounded until they're old enough to drink, at which point everyone should avoid Alamogordo, New Mexico. Also, it looks like in a couple of years, prom night is going to be hell. Yeah. Anyway, boys and girls, it's that moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
It would appear that the lure of posting online, or preparing to post online, is what is bringing idiots bubbling to the surface at a record pace. In this case, deputies arrested a teenager who was making a YouTube video in Land O'Lakes, Florida, to show people how they can cover up home security cameras. 18-year-old Joshua Hendon faces charges of trespassing and loitering. Hendon visited single-family homes to record the tutorial videos. When a deputy approached him, he jumped over a fence into a private property. Hendon also had an outstanding warrant for trespassing. Well, I'm looking forward to his next YouTube video on how to break out of prison. That's assuming the prison has Wi-Fi. In the meantime, why, oh why, would you want to create a YouTube video telling people how to cover up home security cameras by going on other people's property to do it when you already have an outstanding warrant? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0513. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0513. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.